Fredericksburg, Maryland. Please help me welcome Alec B.
Good morning, everybody. My name is Alec. I'm now at home. Good to be here. Good to be sober on a Saturday morning. I have a sobriety date. It's December 23rd, 1996. I'm a home group. I'm a sponsor. I'm current with my sponsor, although technically I'm more current with his voicemail because that was the last conversation I had. He knows where I am. I know where he is. That jerk's in Bermuda right now. I'm having a good time. I want to thank Billy for inviting me to do this and give me the honor of coming and telling you the truth about myself. I'll get through my story if I can. That's all. The only currency we exchange here is our time and the truth about ourselves. So I'm going to tell you about myself and tell you what I was like, what kind of drunk I was. And then if I do this right, I'm going to tell you how I've been changed by Alcoholics Anonymous. Because that's really, I think, the message that we have here. We want to let people know that there's a solution for alcoholism. We want to let people know that there's a way out. We want to let people know, honestly, I think that we're having a good time in sobriety. I'm having a good time. I'm having a great day. I'm having a great week. I'm having a great month. I'm having a great year. And we want to let people know that there's a way out. And it's not a lottery or a duck, duck, goose. It's the result of actions that we take. We have discovered a solution for alcoholism. It was revealed to us and to the earliest AA members that a design for living exists that can expel the obsession to drink. For somebody like me, despite all the mess and problems and the hamster cage that I brought in here, if I do what people in AA do today, I don't have to take a drink today. And with one day of sobriety, that's enough to get me through. And upon that, what do we say, on that cornerstone, a foundation can be built. So I'm gonna tell my story. I'm gonna try and have a little fun with it. I'm a class clown, you know. That's what you get. But it's sanctioned by our book. I brought my little big book here. We think cheerfulness and laughter make for usefulness. That's my favorite line in the big book. Outsiders are shocked when they burst into merriment over a seemingly tragic event out of the past. This will be my last quote. But why shouldn't we laugh? Why shouldn't we laugh? We're having a good time. We're here living, and we're not dying. So let me tell you my story. I want to try and leave a lot of time for talking about sobriety, for talking about what I'm like now and the things that I do today. But you know, it's customary. We give a little backstory here. I want to welcome the newcomers. I want to say I'm looking forward to Joe's talk, and I apologize, John. Sorry, I keep making that mistake, John. And I'm looking. Are you our second speaker? We had a little change up at the end, so I'm looking forward to it. I'll just say I grew up in a small town in Maine, Cape Elizabeth, Maine. It's a pretty little town on the water. It's a suburb of Portland. Small enough that we had two lighthouses and no stoplights, but it's fine to be from a small town. You know. I just grew up knowing that I was destined for bigger things, you know, based on no facts whatsoever. But I felt like big things were brewing for me. I certainly had a lot of potential, and I knew that because of the talks that I've been given about my potential. And some of you may relate to that. And I want to use the little AA decoder ring. If somebody's talking to you about their potential, what they mean is, I'm disappointed in you, but I love you. So just bear that in mind. So I had a lot of potential. Fine place to grow up, and you know, quiet, safe suburb, and all that, and by the ocean. And my parents were divorced, which is, you know, looking back, they got divorced when I was really young, and I just, my perspective on it now is better to grow up in two happy houses than one miserable one. I can be okay with that. And my sister and I grew up mostly in my mother's house, and there were some warnings about alcoholism. My dad's parents actually, so there's no alcoholism in my immediate family. We get all kinds coming into AA. And I like to say, you know, we got some people that'll tell their story and you go, well, of course they turned into an alcoholic. And then you got people like me and you go, man, he ended up as an alcoholic. He had everything going for him. And my father did a great job breaking that cycle. You know, his parents were drunks, and he, I don't know, when I was 10, 11, maybe, he talked to me about that, about the tendency for alcoholism in the family, which that's fine. It's a great bit of information to have. And I was thrilled to have it. And I made a plan right then and there that I was never going to turn into an alcoholic, which is that's a great plan. If you have power, I strongly encourage you not to turn into an alcoholic. You have the power of choice. In fact, even if you could turn it around and just turn off your alcoholism, I'd vote for that too. But we've got some information based on our experience of what that's like. So I had a plan to not be an alcoholic, and that was a good plan until I found out what it feels like to be drunk. And then I had a new plan. And my mother traveled for her work. I was a latchkey kid. I had a lot of freedom at home, which is fine. I say that, you know, a well-adjusted person would have abandonment issues, but I was in heaven. I loved having a place to myself. And coming home after a tough day in junior high and, you know, making myself dinner. And then after, you know, a rough day of freshman year in high school, fixing myself a stiff drink, which is, you know, a responsible man's right. And what really happened is my mother went out of town and she had a liquor cabinet. It had always been there, but one day it just occurred to me. And she had the non-alcoholic liquor cabinet, which can be identified by the dust on the bottles. You know, somebody brought peach schnapps to a Christmas party in 1973, and it's probably still there, but mom had liquor, and there was nobody watching me, and so, you know, I don't mean to brag, I didn't need any formal encouragement in alcoholism or go through any training. I didn't even have to look it up on YouTube, but I knew, go for the clear stuff, cover your tracks, refill it with raw water, and you know, CIA covert operative level. You know, my heartbeat was probably 300 going through that. But I had some vodka. I don't know, maybe 15 or something like that. And I found out how you feel when that alcohol gets in your system. And I will tell you this to the newcomers, welcome. We will not sit you down and ask you why you drank. You will not face that kind of interrogation here. We know. There's no need to ask an alcoholic why, right? I know. And looking back, because much of my drinking is understood in hindsight, in sobriety, once I found out how I could feel when I stole from my mother's liquor cabinet, how could I possibly be okay with being sober? I mean, how could you choose that? How could you wake up and be content with sobriety when you can feel the way you feel when you steal from mom? And so that became my new baseline. Whatever was okay. And I was discontent before. I had not, you know, I did not, you know how when you pick out a car, you choose the trim level? I got the nerd package when I was born, which is, you know, I could have gone for the jock and knows how to talk to girls, but I got the nerd package. And nobody explained in the early 80s that the nerds were actually going to take over. It turned out to be, it played a long game in the 21st century. It worked out well for me. But back then, I was discontent with my circumstances, but stealing from mom's liquor cabinet, I was released. You know, I heard a guy say that in a meeting recently. I was released. And I know what he means. I was released. I was set free. We're going to come back to that later on in the steps where we talk about things like building an arch through which we walk a free man. But I found freedom in alcohol at first as an uncomfortable self self-hating, let's call it what it was, you know, teenager, uncomfortable adolescent. And that opened doors for me to the social scene as a teenager in small towns. I work with younger guys now who have only ever grown up in the world of cell phones, but I have to explain to them, your Friday night might've consisted of 4.5 hours of driving in circles, trying to find other people who were driving in the same circles. You know? But if you hit it right, you'd have a story that you could talk about on Monday morning. Monday mornings were great. They were hilarious. You'd find out who got the new nickname and who rolled a car and who spent a night in jail and who got suspended, you know, whose relationship ended and began sometimes in that order, you know, switched around. And Monday mornings were fun. It was the war stories and the bravado and the bombast. And we didn't talk about the stuff that you talk about in AA meetings, because when I started coming to AA, I'm going to get ahead of myself for a second. People in AA talked about the things that everybody knows you're not supposed to talk about. When you're drinking, when you're telling those rowdy war stories, there's things that you don't talk about. You don't. Now, I am a guy. I was not blessed or cursed with the pass out or blackout. So my drinking nights ended with me alone and my thoughts. And looking at how out of control my drinking got, even as a getting in teenage level nuisance mischief, but the consequences were stacking up. And I, after every drunk, I would make a plan. And the plan was, I'm going to turn things around. It might take a week or two, but I'm going to get the heat off, get my grades up, you know, regain some trust. And that plan only lasts until the phone rings. Somebody makes a better offer. So the guys that I drank with in high school, we were the troublemakers. And so it was our world was the world of going to detoxes and rehabs and getting in trouble and being in hospitals and getting suspended and expelled. That was normal for us. Like the book says, my life became the only normal one that you know, and you acquire the skills that you need to live under those circumstances. Dishonesty. I'll tell you this. Every time I have a drinking dream, I'm not just drinking, I'm drinking and lying, because for me, they're one and the same. Right? There's nothing about my drunk lifestyle that's worth disclosing. I might as well give you a better version of it. So the life that I live, my favorite was your friend's going off to rehab party, because he's got to get rid of this whole stash. He's got rid of it. Everything must go. And then rehabs work. 28 days later, he's coming out. He's not staying sober. So you're having the welcome home from rehab party. And these are my guys. And so we encountered Alcoholics Anonymous. Move this out of the way so I can be a little more emphatic. And so we had conversations about what it might mean if someday we became alcoholics and we had to end up in AA. It's not good. I can't recommend it. What was happening to me is I had lost the power of choice almost from the very beginning. I don't have stories about controlled drinking. Again, nuisance level, teenage dirtbag misfit in a small town. Our police setup was great. They had two cop cars and they'd split the town in half. So if you saw one parked, everything else on that side of town was in bounds because you knew that's where the cop wasn't. And so we'd just drive around and drink and cause trouble. And it was fun and the stories were funny, but inside I'm starting to freak out a little bit because I'm making decisions about, you know, hey, I got to take it easy. I got to back it off. I'm in a lot of trouble at school. The police had come to my house and, you know, I kind of talked my way out of it. But, and it was great. My mother was out of town. We'd never. I think she knows about that one. She's not going to. And, you know, but I liken it to if you've ever been driving and hit black ice. And if you've been through that, you understand there's a point where it doesn't matter what you do with the steering wheel. You're not driving. The ice is in charge. And that's what my drinking was like. I'd make plans left, right, and sideways for how I was going to control and enjoy my drinking, how I was going to throttle it back. But, you know, a better idea always crept in. And I got invited to my first AA meeting. I was 18. I was a senior in high school. One of my friends has brought me with him. And he brought me to a meeting. This is not sanctioned by working with others. He brought me to the meeting where he was going to pick up his 24-hour shift. And but I'll tell you, out of every, what's AA, 2 million people? I think there was maybe one credible messenger that I would listen to at that point. And it was the guy that I drank with. And he brought me to a meeting so he could pick up his 24-hour shift. And he gave me there is a kind of 12-step work that we do for people who aren't ready to get sober, because I've been one of those people. And I try to remember what it's like to be in AA and hate being here. And what my friend explained to me was, he let me know how to find AA, which was, hey, you got to know. I didn't know. Is it a secret society? I wasn't sure. He let me know how to find an AA meeting. He let me know I didn't have to sign up for anything. I didn't have to pay for anything. I could take the coffee without paying anything, which was great. And he let me know that you don't have to be sober to be in an AA meeting as long as you're not disruptive, which was really important, actually, because I wasn't sober in my first day of sobriety. So he gave me the pre-package, you know, getting ready to get ready. And I spent the last year of my drinking occasionally going to meetings. I became a big book owner, which is a step towards sobriety. Taught me a great trick, which I will now share with you, which is how to get a free big book. And he said, you're going to go to the central office, which at the time was in Portland, Maine. And he goes, you go in and you ask them how much a big book costs. And then when they tell you, you don't say anything and you look sad. If you can stand your ground, they will give you a free big book, which is exactly what happened. That's how it works. So So I'll give you that little pearl there. Short on a big book. The funny story, the extension of that is about 20 years later, I went back and repaid for that book with interest. They love the story. A guy there said that it could have been him, I don't know, 20 years ago, even working the desk. But I did pay for my first free scam big book. So I became a drunken big book owner, and boy, the party's over. Man, it's over. If you are doing what I do, I thought the answer was getting out of mom's house. I thought the answer was college. I knew a lot about higher education because I'd seen Animal House, and I felt like that was a place where I could blossom and flower and come into all that potential in pursuit of my education. And I picked a school where I could run wild. And I thought that was going to be the answer. I thought, man, I worked so hard at lying about my drinking. Won't it be, it's just more efficient. You know, what do I spend 40% of my time lying about my drinking? Why don't I just go where I can just let my hair down? And that wasn't the answer. Getting out of mom's house wasn't the answer. I went off to college. I brought my secret big book with me in case I developed alcoholism. The levels of delusion here are staggering. I mean, the party is over. If you have a secret big book that you don't want people to find out about, you're done. You're not getting it back. I don't know any nicer way to say it, but, you know, and I made it through one semester of college. My sobriety date is December 23rd. That is the Christmas break of my freshman year of college. I made it through one semester. I was solidly in the middle of the road that leads out of college, although it hadn't caught up with me yet. But I came home and I went back to AA. It's a Monday morning. It's a Monday morning in December where it's just warm enough to rain and not snow. I mean, if you're looking for misery, you know, the soundtrack would be all piano and it would just be awful. And I went back to that new meeting, and I'd been hitting the cough syrup pretty hard the night before. And so the room was doing the cruise ship thing. You know, everybody else was standing vertically when I was listening to port. But I made it through a new meeting. By the end of it, I was sober, and I was glad my friend had told me, you don't have to be sober to go to an AA meeting. You know, and that's what I took. And that was my first day of sobriety. It's not a podium worthy story. There's really not much to it. You know, I was beaten up. I was tired. I was just really tired. I was telling lies that you know you're going to get caught for. I don't know, but you just do it sometimes just to stay in shape. My parents have been asking me how school was going, how are your grades. I was just drinking all the time, around the clock. I developed the ability to wake up without moving or opening my eyes. That is an important survival skill. You got to assess the situation before you let anybody know you're up. These are the things we learn. And it was my first day of sobriety. The thing that changed, now I quit drinking a lot. I want to talk about this. I want to brag a little bit about how good I am at stopping drinking, because I did it all the time. I had a lot of practice. So the all Alec world record is I quit drinking forever 3 times in one day. It's not easy to do. You have to start early. But I think, hear me out. I think some of us have probably gone through this. What do? You wake up and you quit drinking forever. And then you find a little bit left over. So you have the hair of the dog, which, you know, and then leads you into round one for the day. By mid-afternoon, you can quit forever again. And then the phone rings, you know, and then it's Miller time, and you know, and then by the end of the night, this is the time that you're serious. So that's how it's done. I hope nobody has to practice that. I quit drinking all the time. Usually the common element was isolation. Usually my plan was if I can cut myself off from everybody in the environment that I'm in. I mean, I knew there was a problem there, but I didn't understand how deeply it ran. And so the Alec alone plan, the other AA, you know, worked occasionally. One time I used what I call the Mississippi method. I took a job in Mississippi because I knew nobody there. And all I did was work and go home and watch TV. And I kept that up over summer break for 6 weeks. 6 weeks of sobriety cost me nothing. But all those temporary sobrieties, you know, I can stop drinking, but I can't stop starting again. And in back of all of it is the knowledge that I might have to go back to AA, which is the last thing I want. But I came here because there was no other place I knew of where I could go. I knew that there was a place called Alcoholics Anonymous where people go when they can't stop drinking. And I came back here. That's how bad, you want to know how bad it got? I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. How low can you stoop? And I came back to AA. And it was going to be me versus alcoholism again. But what was different this time is I met, this never happened to me. I was 19. I bumped into a guy my age. And it should not happen to me in a meeting. It means I'm going to the youngest guy. And so I asked him to sponsor me. I didn't vet his credentials or anything like that. I know sometimes you get heavy into auditioning my sponsors, but I was just scared and alone. And so for the first time, it wasn't just me versus alcohol. For the first time, there was somebody in my corner, which is really how AA started. Our AA's birthday is a Bill Wilson sobriety day. It's when we got a second guy sober, when we had a fellowship here, when we had power greater than one alcoholic. And so for the first time, it wasn't just me. And I made it through. And it was a tough, you know, I came back. My first couple months of sobriety were still living in a dorm, still surrounded by drinking. And my sponsor did the best he could, but he was a newcomer like me as well. I mean, that's proof to me that two people who are gathered for the purpose of sobriety are sufficient power. But we were making it up as we went along. So we were still, you know, I was still trying to live a double life. I was trying to be in the parties and also do AA. It was a real mess, and I just wanted to drink all the time. It wasn't great. I know a lot of people who have stories like that that drink again. I don't know why. I don't know. Too proud, too lucky. Better to be lucky than smart. And but I got plugged in. I actually want to talk about this if I can for a minute. I took a summer job. I was about 6 months sober. And I grew up in Maine. My college was in New York State. And I took a summer job in the state of Maryland, in a much bigger county, much larger place, big city AA. And I encountered what was to become my home group. I'd never been really involved in a home group. And I was thinking about this just Thursday night because I took kind of a funny route through Bethesda, and I drove past the church where I met my home group for the first time. And newcomer move, I walked up to the front door of the church, which was locked. I mean, you're an A little while, you figure out, you go right back. But here's what I was thinking about. I was at a stoplight, actually a few minutes, and I was looking at the church, and I was thinking about, you know, there was a day when I was almost 6 months sober, and I had one friend in AA. I'd never brewed a cup of coffee. I never put away a chair. I'd never really done anything. There was really nothing holding me there, and I walked up to the door of a church, and I was 5 minutes away from being introduced to the sunlight of the spirit and meeting an active and involved group. And so many things followed from that. But in that moment, I didn't know. And we say that. We say, don't quit 5 minutes before the miracle. And I had no idea on that Saturday night. I thought, of, you know, I'd plop down in the meeting, steal some coffee, and go on my way. But I encountered, I'd been around AA, but I hadn't been around enthusiastic AA. And we're careful not to, you know, give the impression that there are levels here, but you know, we know when the sober rapture comes that some of the groups are going to make it. No, but I'll tell you, in a serious way, we went through something a couple of years ago with COVID where our fellowship was really tested, really, really hard in groups that didn't have some of those core elements of service ethic that holds us together, but also the fellowship that is the, I think, the fabric that binds us. We really had a tough time. We saw it up in my county, the number of meetings that just dropped to almost nothing. And we're still in the process of rebuilding. But I, you know, had the fortune to encounter active, very, very active AA. And I came in with lots of problems and the hamster was still spinning up there, you know. And I had been a big book owner, but I actually asked somebody to sponsor me who is an experienced member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can't say enough about sponsorship and about having a well-informed AA member tell you about the solution and then take you through it. And my sponsor's policy is pretty simple. If it's in the book, we do it. That's actually the end of the conversation. It's not the entrance to the discussion. That's it. And I started down a journey, and where it ends up is a change in values. And our book talks about a couple things. It talks about a personality change. I want to give some bad news to the newcomers here, which is there's one thing on the menu, and we hope you like it. What's on the menu here is a change in values, and we hope that you come to believe in the hopelessness of your situation and the necessity of self-sacrifice, belief in a power greater than yourself, and the willingness to sacrifice your time for the benefit of others, often thankless sacrifice. And all of those things happen. And the thing about that is, I don't know that there's a way to think your way into that. In our history and in our prehistory, we look back to guys like the psychiatrist Carl Jung, who did his part to help alcoholics, but he acknowledged the shortcomings of medicine and psychiatry. He said, people stop drinking, but it's not something that can be manufactured. It's a change. People undergo a change in values, and he observed it generally when people became involved with church. But as we know, there are plenty of church-going guys. There are lots of people who look for an answer in the church. And I'm not sure why some people get it, but most of us don't. And it's not my business to know that. Thankfully, I've had a great sobriety with no theology behind it whatsoever. That's not important. So in our origins, we found out that it is necessary to live a life based on principle and live differently. And again, wouldn't have signed up for that at the door. Come on in. You got coffee and values, you know. But you guys kind of took the roundabout way to sneak in. And, you know, I learned things like I'm uncomfortable talking to people, so I can put away chairs and look busy and people leave me alone. And that was enough. That was a start. That was something. You know, I did a thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. I put away a chair. I put away an ashtray, if I'm dating myself a little bit. And I began to do things in AA. And at the same time, I, you know, read the big book through osmosis, started going to big book meetings, 12 and 12 meetings. There's a temptation because of my nerd side. It would be tempting for me to become a big book memorizer and talk about what's on what page. And I have no problem with people who do that. I just prefer, I think that's a trap for me. I'm just, you know, I would throw out my shoulder, patting myself on the back, and I could memorize the paper. So, but there's some things that I picked up along the way that I really like, and I try to share with you. So, my sobriety then has been a journey of uncovering, discovering, and discarding, and trying to live, trying to look at my past, trying to clean things up, and trying to be honest about the challenges. So there are some things that were difficult for me in AA. When I came to my first AA meeting, I read the steps that talk about a power greater than ourselves, capital P power. And my hopes were dashed when I read that because I thought, well, somebody like me will never make it in a place like this. I brought belligerence and hostility and closed-mindedness. And I thought, well, this is for a type of person that I'm not. I'm not the type of person that will do well in fellowship like this. And what I can report to you based on my experience is that we have a second step here. We've got a lot of bad news in the first step. A lot of bad news. First step is bad news. Don't be an alcoholic. I never admit it, you know. But our second step is the beginning of the way out. And what I have found is our second step, in my opinion, is one size fits all. We only have the one second step, but I have yet to meet an alcoholic that's unable to find something that they consider a power greater than themselves that can relieve their alcoholism. And it could be just making a friend in AA. It could be the fact that when I sit through an hour meeting, I feel better when I leave than I did when I came in. That's a powerful experience for an alcoholic. If you are, you know, if you've got your advanced degree and feeling awful and you come in here and sit for an hour and feel a little bit better, something is happening. We don't need to explain it. We're not scientists. We don't have to explain it, but we talk about results, and the result of sitting there for an hour is I often feel better than I did when I came in. That's a power greater than myself. I believed in and respected my sponsor's experience. So there was a power greater than myself. He wasn't a God, never will be, but I respect and admire how he acts and how he conducts himself in an AA meeting. I watch him. He's not disruptive. He's not on his phone. He sits down and kind of thing. You know, and he makes it important to go out and talk to people and impact them. And for some people, you will come here and you'll see that, and that will work great for you because you may bring in a faith that works that you've never been able to activate and be a solution for alcoholism. So there are some people come in and say, God's great. I sponsor a lot of guys like that. I'm like, why can't I get some of the belligerent jerks like me? I've got my best material for these people. And then somebody asked me to sponsor them, and I'm like, what about God? And they're like, God's great. You're giving me nothing here, dude. You know? And if that's you, and if that's what you bring to AA, there are things that will probably flow smoothly for you. That's great. That's great. Why should we have to struggle? We shouldn't have, that shouldn't be a requirement. We shouldn't have to struggle with this. There are some people that are delighted to be in a spiritual fellowship that might even return them to their roots and help what they have become even richer and more vibrant. That's great. Why shouldn't it be that way? Right? Just because I had a tough time. And so I found out that our second step is one size fits all. And even somebody like me can have a change in values. Now I've become an open-minded person. I fall into the category that's explained in the 12 and 12 ask, reconsider or die. Those are my choices. I'm ready for a fight. And my options are reconsider or die. I have to admit that AA shows results. I have to admit that people are living well. I have to admit that when I do what people in AA do, I don't take a drink. It's astonishing. And I have to acknowledge that how I feel most of the time. My spirits are up most of the time. There's no theology in that whatsoever, but my spirits are up in AA. I'll tell you this, the music that I relate to has changed. How about that? Let's set the bar low. Anybody, you know, used to sit down, and I try to explain this now to my newer, younger guys. I'm like, man, you know how tough it was to listen to a sad song and stop the tape and rewind it? You know, now you can just put it on repeat and really get into that hole. But, you know, you'd have to rewind, and then you'd get to, like, the happy song before the sad song, which kind of break the spell. The music that I relate to now has changed. I don't know. Just sort of happened along the way when I was busy. How am I doing? When do we go? 9:30? 10:30. All right, good stuff. Well, what's important to talk about? You know, a change in values that can't be thought into, but has to be acted into, the importance of sacrifice. So let me tell you a little bit about my day and how, I'll do the steps and how about this? I'm going to talk about this. Sometimes I sit in meetings, sometimes I judge in meetings. But I came up with my judgment checklist. There's a couple of things that I like hearing about in a meeting. And sometimes I'll be in a discussion meeting and I'm not hearing any of the things that I think are pretty core. So what I like hearing about in meetings, I like hearing about God. I like hearing about groups. I like hearing about the big book. I like hearing about steps, service, sponsorship, and surrender. And I got to hear somebody talk about drinking. I've been to some meetings where you never really touch on that. And when I'm in a meeting, so sitting in a meeting judging isn't really productive, but if I'm not hearing those things, then I'll try to bring up some of those. I'll try to talk about it. I think I've touched on a few. I mentioned sponsorship. Surrender is a tough one. That takes a while for the change in values so that surrender becomes one of my tools. My old tools, like I told you, they were, you know, lying, you know, never admit it, even if they've got you back into a corner. But surrender becomes a tool when you're no longer in charge of the universe. The alternative, this is explained to me. I got two choices. I can surrender or I can learn to control people with brainwaves. And one of those is a lot easier than the other. And so we end up talking a lot about surrender because I'm not the guy in charge anymore. There's a very small corner of the universe that I'm in charge of, and it's my attitude. And even that's crummy sometimes, although I've learned some shortcuts to get around that. But I've learned to surrender and keep in mind that something better might be around the corner. Just like when I pulled on that locked door handle at that church on Saturday night, something good was in store. I didn't know it. And you get to, if you can do this, you can become one of those nuisance old timers, which I've kind of become. There's no actual formal like knighthood ceremony that you become, like, you know, guardian of the traditions. But I've really gotten into telling people that things are going to be okay, because we bring our problems here. We do that. It's very important to be able to bring your problems and your troubles here. And I've gotten pretty good at telling people that things are going to be okay because I know a little secret. And how, I mean, what right do I have to promise somebody that something's going to be okay when I can't see the future? Well, here's the secret. I know things are going to be okay because we just don't know what okay is going to look like. But it's going to be okay. Things are going to be all right. I've watched people go through things. We have all kinds of tragedy and circumstance and unfortunate things. And then could be a few weeks, months, years later, you look around and go, hey, you know, things are okay. We got through it. We got through it. You know, I'm having a great life. My life is second to none. I married a lovely woman in the program. She sobered longer than me, which is probably the only way that my ego could survive. And, you know, we have a beautiful daughter who's 12 and a half. When our daughter was 2 weeks old, my wife had a heart attack. Things were not okay. That wasn't in the plan. That wasn't in the little baby book, what to do when you're expecting, yeah. And but we got through it. Things are okay. Things are fine. We got through it. The AA Army showed up, as it often does. The food, you know, the food arrived. You know, we got the help we needed. Things were not okay, but they were okay. And so now I can say to other people, I mean, it's easy because it's not my problem. You know, the easiest part about the third step is recommending it to others. But I can tell them, like, sometimes you're gonna be okay. We get fired, we get sick, we have car trouble, and we get those kinds of things, you're gonna be okay. And I know, and I'm sure as you do too, plenty of people who look around and see circumstances and say things are okay. I've got a different baseline as a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I haven't thrown up behind a dumpster in a significant period of time. And when you remember where the baseline is, it can give me a new perspective. Now I need constant tune-ups and tweaks on that. So we do things like gratitude lists. That's something I learned early on. My old grand sponsor was a drug dealer. He goes, everybody knows how scales work, especially drug dealers, right? And he goes, you got gratitude and self-pity. When one of them's up, the other's down. When my self-pity is up, I need to buff up my gratitude and the self-pity. I don't know where it goes. It comes back. It doesn't leave, you know, but temporarily it's gone. So we do things like gratitude lists. We check in with each other a lot. We spend a lot of time. And I say this sometimes, but you know, I have a few criticisms of AA. It's okay. You can't really blaspheme against AA. One of the things, the thing on our chips, you know, it says, I know self be true. What the hell is that? Nobody talks like that. Why do they put that on the chip? I don't know that I've ever said that to anybody. And I would go on record. I think our chip should say, how you doing? That's 1,000 times a day. How's it going, man? How you doing? You know, you shared about something last week. How'd that go? Because we check in. We have a common welfare and we have a responsibility to look out for each other. And that's why the fellowship is so important. To be able to tell people, you know, when you're having a bad day. I can remember making it to the meeting at night. It's like sliding into home, man. You know, my days were a disaster. When I was new, it was pre-cell phone. I built a good habit. And sometimes you do that. You build good habits. Every morning I would take, the payphone was 35 cents. And I would take a quarter and a dime every day. And I'd call my sponsor with a crisis du jour until the day I called him and said, hey, I'm at work. Call me back in 10 minutes. And he hung up. So that's when I started bringing 70 cents a day. We check in with each other because I would have one disaster after another. I had no life skills, you know, and I just barely make it to the meeting. But I felt like, if I can just get here and drink 20 to 30 ounces of coffee, be able to live. I had no life skills. I joke about this. You know, I said 19 when I got sober. There was a day I went to the mall during the day one time, and just something had been on my mind for a while. And I went into a store that sold clothes, and I pulled a guy aside and said, "You know, when people say when they're talking about clothes, you know, they say colors match. What does that mean?" And he looked at me for a second and thought I was serious. And so I started getting lessons on like how to wear clothes, you know, that don't look like they came out of the trunk of my car. And I started asking for help, and I started learning the tools that we have. Like, if I'm struggling with somebody, with something, think about somebody who might have shared about getting through that earlier and ask them what they did. So AA is really big on, you know, you can bring problems. We love it when you bring problems. My sponsor is really great at receiving a problem and giving me an action to take instead. Whether I agree on a connection or not, a lot of my problems are solved by phone calls to people that can't help me, right? You know, you got this, right? But I'm often given things to do, you know, and a sponsorship has helped me sort out, like our serenity prayer, things I can do things about and things that I can't. There's footwork I can take, and then there's results that I'm not in charge of. And I've gotten through a lot of things by playing the long game, just waiting it out. A lot of stuff clears out. a lot of the crises, my romance in early sobriety that failed. You know, the girl who wanted to marry had other notions, like standing with a boyfriend. And those things worked out, not in the way that I thought, but in meeting my wife. We just celebrated 20 years of marriage last year. We're having a great time.
We're having
a fantastic time. Sober together. Our home is a safe place. You know, our daughter's never seen us drunk. That's great. That's great. And that's not a requirement. There's people that bring in a lot of tough family situations, and we can work with that as well. You don't have to get sober at 19 to start to rebuild family. I had some responsibilities that I had to take care of within my family. I had to clean up my past with my parents, my sister, and some other people. You know, the amends process was, I'll tell a couple of stories if I can. You know, I was supposed to make a list from my sponsor of things I had done, and I was supposed to write down some things I could do where I thought I could set it straight. And I had nothing in that last column because I had never made something right before in the past. I just walk away. You know, you hope your mom and aunt cleans it up for you, but if not, you just, you know, just end the relationship and move on. And so I had no idea. So my sponsor was very helpful. You know, I thought that the money ones were going to be the toughest. They're pretty simple. But sitting down with people and talking about what a disappointment you've been and how would they like the relationship to be in the future. Most of my drinking had a very small blast radius, but the people that cared about me were very deeply impacted by it. So I had to talk with my mother and my father. But they both said the same thing. They want to be involved in my life. They want to know what's going on. And so I began calling them. And I call my mother and my father every Sunday. I've been doing it for 26 years, you know. And then they retired and they started calling me because they're bored, but that's fine. You know, I paid my father back. I owed him a substantial sum of money. I can't remember exactly what happened. I think my tax refund came in and I was able to mail him a check. My sponsor said, just put it in the mail, write a little note, but it's for, don't make a big deal out of it. And I remember this. I told the story last time I was speaking down here. I was coming home from work and he called me and he had opened the mail and he had found it. I said, I got the check in the mail. Oh, great. Yeah, you know what that's for, right? Yeah, I goes, you know, I have some beliefs about parenting. I don't think we lend money to our children. When I gave you money, I never expected any of that back. That's not my intention. Good news to me. Good thing instead of cash, right? You know, and I can almost feel the money coming back from my bank account. There's this pause and goes, but you know, this is for your sobriety. So I'm going to felt like I'd been stolen from somehow. I couldn't really do the math, but he's been supportive all along. Same thing, you know, with my mother, and we're current now. We're in touch. But that wasn't the end. The book says, is, you know, something like, you know, it's nice. What does it say? It's nice that we try and clean up our past. It's nice, but that's not the end. We're setting ourselves up. Oh, take notes, right? This is Alex, how to sound smart in AA. If you want to sound like an expert on this kind of step, you say, well, you know, the purpose of this step is really to set you up for the next step. Well, the purpose of the ninth step is really to set you up for the tenth. Do a good tenth step. That's nice. It sets you up to do prayer and meditation. It sets you up to carry an effective message. So I had to clean up my past. And as a result of that, I became a different person. So when I go and talk to a newcomer, I don't talk about how I'm just undrunk. I talk about how I'm a different person, how I react differently. I respond differently to the world. People's interactions with me are different. If you cross paths with me during the day, it's not the low point of your day anymore. there are conversations I have with people that are entirely unmemorable to me. You know what I'm saying? Alcoholics can make a lasting impression. But I set myself up to be able to talk about how I've been changed by Alcoholics Anonymous and the shift in values. So let me say something. I sponsored a guy out of state and we were talking about his home group and he's got an active group. It's a younger people's group. But like a lot of AA, they get people coming in and they get people who overdose and die, which is awful. And it's really tragic. But he said something really interesting. He said, there's a group of people within his group and they're always the ones that are relapsing and dying. And again, we're not making light of this. This is awful, awful stuff. But we were talking about how is it that there's a group within a group that are so close to the solution? And again, I'm not making any distinction between alcoholic and addict. That's if you're an alcoholic who has also used drugs, you should find somebody that you can talk to outside of the meeting to figure out, do you have a place in AA? It's really important to know whether or not you belong here. But really what we were talking about is people who were so close to AA, but just on the periphery. And what we're thinking is maybe they never got, and these are, you can come in and you can make some coffee from time to time and be at events and be at meetings. We were thinking maybe people never got that, that change in values to the importance of self-sacrifice for others. We were thinking maybe that was the thing. Like maybe people come in here and they're getting good stuff, but they don't necessarily come to believe that it's vitally important to give up their time. And I will tell you this, I do. I have a prayer and meditation practice, and I think about, and I try to, I'm gonna come back to this, I promise. This is the way my brain works, that we go out and we come back. I think about, I look for guidance from God, and it's very unexciting, it's very unglamorous, but I think about four basic areas. I think about the guys I sponsor, my family, the meetings I attend, and the alcoholics in my area that haven't made it to AA yet. And I just think, is there something I should be doing? But sometimes a thought will pop in. Oh yeah, not somebody told me about something a while ago. I should check in on them, see how he's doing, right? But I think about my day and I try to think, should I be making some adjustments there to do a little bit more? Should I, has it been me all day long? Should I put a little more room in there to be available for Alcoholics Anonymous and to be of service? And not because I'm a good person, but I'll tell you, it's because what I believe has changed. I can stand here and tell you what I value, but if you want to know what I value, just follow me around. And that applies for anybody. You want to know what people believe? Watch what they do. I'm a person who believes it's important to make time for others. It's not my favorite, not by a long shot. It's not fun. You know, when I wake up in the morning and I consider my day, I'm considering the fact that my day is full. Thank you very much. I'm thinking about what I want, what I need, my responsibilities, me. Have you ever seen when they crash the car in slow motion and the airbag deploys? It's like that. My day is full of me. There's about 4 nanoseconds in the beginning, right? And then it fills up with everything I want, everything I need. And there is some kind of surrender that I must do where I must put some of my agenda on the back burner to make room for others. Again, not crazy about it. My guys call me. I don't know how they do it. They have a gift for calling at the wrong time when I'm busy with something I want. You know? And as I said, you can sigh, but not after you pick up. Hey, well, I got time, love. Great time to call. And my sponsor's really practical. He actually said, you know, if somebody sponsor calls, your screen's got to be off. Any screen in front of you should be off when you're talking to somebody. You know, they deserve. I made a commitment to the men I sponsor. I'm going to keep up my end of the bargain, and I'm going to give them my time. I'm going to pay attention to how they're doing. I mean, you know, there's the machine. But I owe it to them, and it benefits me. Pay attention and to think about, you know, what it would be like. And what's the result of that? You develop compassion. You develop the ability to understand that everybody's got their stuff too. You know, I made amends to my parents and then slowly along the line started seeing them as human beings. You know, they were like, I don't know, it's the little vending machines, you know, that's kind of what I thought of them as. That's why I understood that they were people. And you start seeing everybody that way, even the people in front of you in the checkout line and in traffic and all that. You know, I had a great, this is going to be a very DC-centric story. I once for about a year, I had a really tough commute, but it was on a road that led to an airport. And when people were tailgating me, I thought, maybe they're just late. I've been late. It's tough. It's the worst. You know, I just, why get angry? You know, maybe just let it pass, you know, if we can. And didn't change anything about the world, but it changed some things about me. It changed my interactions with others. So that tight spring started to release a little bit. You know? And I think we shoot for that. I think we go for peace of mind, you know, and insurance against taking another drink. I get to a lot of meetings. It's tough. I was a meeting a day guy for 13 years until my daughter was born. I'll tell you, you know what the good schedule is for meetings? It's whatever your sponsor says. Okay, sponsor. So my sponsor helped me set a schedule before I was a parent, and then he helped me set a schedule with a newborn and all that. And I get to 4 or 5 meetings a week now, and it works out. We have a good arrangement between me and my wife. And I'm able to be in meetings, and I'm able to hear what happens to people who don't go to meetings. I'm able to meet people who are in need of help. I'm able to let people know what's going on with me. I'm able to have service responsibilities and commitments that I can stick to, and get that constant reminder of who and what I really am. There's a line I like in the 12 and 12. It says in the first step, it talks about our devastating weakness and all its consequences. There's nothing, there's no bravado in that. Talking about my devastating weakness and all its consequences. But if you hear me say to you, I'm an alcoholic, you know pretty much what you need to know about me. There's some details there, but you know. And you know what I was like. You know I was no good. You know what the kind of thoughts I was having at night, at the end of my drinking, or in the morning when I woke up to consequences. And I get to understand my devastating weakness and all its consequences. So if you're an alcoholic, there's a lot of consequences. I believe we're getting into the realm of my opinion. I'm not gonna back it up here. With the literature, the consequences of being an alcoholic are that people like me generally drink again without external intervention, which we find in AA. A consequence of my devastating weakness is it's important for me to devote time to spiritual growth. It's important for me to devote time to helping others. It's important for me, and I'm fairly outgoing, but the battery has a finite lifespan. So sometimes I get to meetings and I'd rather talk to the people I know and I've been friends with for a long time, but it takes a little bit of effort to get over that hump and introduce myself to somebody new. Now, it's where all my new friends are coming from. I don't know why that would be tough for me, but it is sometimes, you know, and if that's you, if you relate to it, I understand, but that's a consequence of my devastating weakness. It's not enough for me to surround myself with the contented. I need to get to the people who need help and make time for them. I don't know that I have any terrific closing thoughts. You know, I'm trying to be a different person because the old guy needed a drink. I was a guy that needed a drink. I wake up in the morning and I drank out of necessity. It was fun, but it was necessary. And when I woke up this morning, I didn't need a drink. It was a fine morning, fine April morning in Virginia. My phone wasn't ringing. It's like tax day. You know what I mean? It's like, I remember driving with a new guy this time of year, and I was talking about doing my taxes, and he goes, "You have all your W-2s already?" And I think about that for a second. We were living in different worlds. I'm going to end a few minutes early, actually, so that we can talk. But I want to end with this, something that I heard. And I'll tell you, I try to always be adding a little bit more in. I'm a voracious reader. I'm always reading. And I usually have, I'm terrible at it. I've usually got like a history book and a fiction book and a spirituality book and a business book. And I don't know. But when I got into, during the pandemic, I got really into the history of AA and the Oxford group. It just, you know, kept me out of trouble for a while. But I also listened to AA speakers from all over, and we're fortunate now. When I got sober, I helped record my home group and did a lot with cassettes and then CDs. And now there's a whole wealth of it online, which is probably flagrantly in violation of the traditions. I don't know. I'm not your guy for that. But I've found so many great speakers. And I heard something recently with guys, Chuck C, kind of a legend in Alcoholics Anonymous. And at the time he was giving a talk, he was 34 years sober, and he was a very gifted speaker. He's good at hooking the audience. And he goes, "I'm going to tell you right now how I've been able to not take a drink for 34 years. Pregnant pause. Great speaker. And he goes, "The reason I haven't taken a drink is that I'm able to live peacefully, happily, and comfortably with myself because of you. So I haven't needed to go get that from a bottle." And man, I had to hit pause there, because that's my story. Because of you, I'm able to live peacefully, happily, and comfortable with myself. And I don't need to go chase that down in a bottle. I have lost the power of choice in drink. That can be me again someday. I hope and pray that it's not. It can be if I'm vigilant. Maybe I'll say this as the last thing. Alcoholics Anonymous is a power sufficient to overcome alcoholism. It can expel the obsession to drink. And it has in my life. And when you first discover that, it's amazing. That's astonishing, right? We've been hoping all along that there's an answer, but there's a mystery behind that. So the first mystery gets solved quickly. Yep, there's something you can do. If you do what people in AA do, you don't have to take a drink. Oh, that's great. But here's the real mystery. How do people like us continue to do that day in and day out? corner cutters, excuse makers, great sprinters, terrible marathoners like ourselves. And I thought the power was freedom from a drink one day at a time. That's a great power. But over time, I have been introduced to the power behind that, which is being carried day after day after day. And some days I'm leading the charge and some days I'm being carried, but the fellowship of AA has over and over recharged my batteries and rekindled my enthusiasm for the work that we do. And I have been so overpaid in this fellowship to go from throwing up behind a dumpster to standing in front of you, telling the truth about myself. I'm a grateful alcoholic. Thank you for being a part of my sobriety.